You are listening to A Scary State, and this week we're talking about Indiana. So, Mackenzie?
Yes, Lauren?
Let's get scary. All right, so this week I have one of my best friends on the show. We have been friends for 17 years. Yep. So, hi, Mackenzie.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here with me. So, I do, as we jump into this, have a little bit of true crime news.
Ooh.
Okay, so this is a story from our neck of the woods.
You mean, like, where we grew up?
Like Loudoun County.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So a 21-year-old from Leesburg, Virginia, was arrested and charged with the second-degree murder of his father.
What?
A brewery owner in Loudoun County. He's also being charged with credit card theft and credit card fraud. So Dean Lake was Skylar Lake's father. Skylar Lake was the 21-year-old.
Uh-huh.
He was found dead on Saturday with apparent trauma to the upper body.
Wow.
Yeah. So Skylar Lake went on the run for a little bit. It was like a day or two. And then he was picked up and has already been charged.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Credit card fraud and murder.
Very
different crimes.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Is there a reason, like, why did he kill his dad?
Apparently, the house, like, stuff at home was, like, very, like, tumultuous. Mom's not in the picture.
Yeah.
Like, relationship with dad is horrible.
Yeah. Wow.
But, yeah, so that's wild.
That is wild.
And then, okay, I have a scary story that happened.
Okay
so... This past weekend, Joe went out of town to play golf with some of his friends. Mm-hmm. So it was just me and Roy in the house. So I have been wanting to watch Midsommar for a really long time, but Joe wouldn't watch it with me again. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to watch it by myself. And it's like a scary movie of this girl who goes to a cult. It's really good.
I'm never going to watch it.
I think you'd like it. It's not like haunted house scary. I think watch it with me. You'll like it.
Maybe.
You might not like it, but we'll watch it. And so anywho, so I go to bed kind of late that night because it was Saturday night, so why not? And I went to bed at like 11:30. So at 2:30 in the morning, I'm like jolted awake.
Oh, God.
And I wake up to like the – so how our house is set up, we have our main floor and then we have a loft upstairs and we sleep in the loft. What?
2 seconds. I'm like, why are you explaining to me?
For some of those people who have not been in my house.
Like, I'm like nodding my head being like, oh, wait, they can't see you nod your head. Like, you so I forgot that we're recording this. And so you're telling everybody this story.
Yeah. So as you know, Mackenzie, from our loft, you can see down into our living room where our TV is and stuff. And so, yeah, so I sprung awake at 2:30 because our TV downstairs had turned on randomly.
Oh, my God.
It was so terrifying. So I like tiptoed downstairs and I like looked around and I turned it off and I come back up. And I was like, what if this was a serial killer's attempt to like turn it on and scare me and wake me up? And now there's someone in my house because, you know, I think there's someone in my house all the time because of the creepy attic. So
why would they want to wake you?
I don't.
They killed you.
I don't know, to scare me or something. So anywho, it was terrifying. And then I guess I was just so tired that I thought about how scared I was, and then I fell asleep. So
that put you to sleep?
Well, I was so scared, and it was like 2:30 in the morning, and I just fell back asleep.
Well, I would have been awake for the rest of the night, but
yeah.
And did it only do it that once?
Uh huh. So but see, it's happened – okay, so that's happened twice since we've owned the TV. One time when Joe's been here, obviously, and then the other time has to happen when I'm all by myself.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you're
very terrifying. I hope not. But like I said, we've heard, like, weird things, and Roy is freaked out by the room we're currently recording in. You're welcome. And that's the door that he destroyed to get into because there was something in this room that he needed to see.
Huh.
I don't know.
And like, you have a ghost.
We might, because when I'm in the bathroom in our room, he guards it. Like, he'll stand outside the door and guard it as I'm in there by myself.
Hmm.
It's very creepy.
Maybe it's Albert. Maybe he left my apartment and came here.
Maybe they're friends.
Maybe
there's two ghosts.
Maybe. I could give you the sweater vest.
So Mackenzie has a ghost in her house. She randomly had a sweater vest show up.
Don't know who it belongs to.
I told her to keep it as to not anger the ghost who it is attached to.
Yeah,
so now
it just hangs on my closet.
Yeah.
Don't know who it belongs to.
He's a nice ghost, apparently. He hasn't done anything yet. So.
He's a naked ghost, too.
All right, so let's get into Indiana.
All righty.
It's the Hoosier State, right?
Huh? I don't know.
I think so. Okay. Indiana, nicknamed the Hoosier State. I need to look this up. I don't want anyone to think I'm stupid. Hoosier.
You would have said that so wrong.
Indiana. nicknamed the Hoosier State, and I looked that up so I know it's right, joined the Union on December 11th, 1816, and became the 19th state. No one really knows where the word Hoosier comes from, but there are many theories. Among the most popular are, when a visitor would knock on a door, the owner would yell, Hoosier! Like, it was there. Another,
it's like a bad knock-knock joke.
I know, but that's what it is. Another is that the rivermen here were so good at beating or hushing their adversaries in brawls that these men became known as hushers, which over time became hoosers. Hoosers?
What's a riverman?
I guess people who work on the river? I don't know. This was a long time ago. Like, long time ago people.
Long time ago.
It has also been nicknamed the Crossroads of America and the Hospitality State. The Hospitality State nickname shows up on Indiana license plates.
Hmm.
Indiana translates to Land of the Indians or Indian Land. Some weird laws. Sense. Yeah. In Warsaw, it is illegal to throw your couch at your neighbor.
I mean, if you could.
If you could do that. Between the months of October and March, you are not allowed to take a bath in Indiana, which would suck because those are the perfect bath months.
Can you shower?
Yeah. You just can't, like, lie in a bath.
Why?
I don't know. Some weird laws that they have in Indiana. In Gary, in order to go to the movies, to see a show, or to get on public transportation, you have to go 4 hours without eating garlic. Which is very thoughtful.
Honestly, I think everybody should do that.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to smell that.
Yeah, I agree. And if you are driving down Main Street in Evansville, it will be illegal for you to drive your vehicle with the lights on.
Even at night?
I think so, which seems very counterintuitive.
Unless it's like a really bright street.
Yes. There's no way to know.
Interesting.
Unless we go there. Hmm. Indiana is the least expensive state in the U.S., west of the Appalachian Mountains. And also in Evansville, you can try a real brain on a bun.
Ew.
So like a sandwich at the Hilltop Inn is legit a pig brain sandwich.
Ew.
Yeah, I don't think I would want that. There's this thing called the Shoe Tree located in Milltown. It is literally a tree that is covered in shoes.
Hmm.
No one knows how this started or why, but people still add their shoes to this tree to this day.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah. The town of Muncie is well known for its UFO sightings. Several police reports state people seeing triangular objects that hide behind orange clouds.
Hmm.
A portal to hell may also be located inside of a house in this town.
Hmm.
There is a weird phenomenon that happens in Kokomo. There is a dull and endless hum that can be heard just in the air in Kokomo, but only 2% of the population can hear it. No one knows where the hum is coming from or how to stop it, and it has been dubbed the Kokomo Hum. There is also a creepy tunnel called the Big Tunnel, located in Tunnelton.
Perfect.
Right. It is rumored to be haunted by a man who died while the tunnel was being originally built. He is seen carrying a lantern in one hand and his head in the other.
Ew.
And according to the research we always use from Radford University and Florida Gulf...
my alma mater.
Your alma mater. And Florida Gulf Coast University, Indiana is in the top 11 states with the largest number of serial killer victims at 341 since 1900.
We can talk about one of them today.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
And Indiana has 8 known serial killers. Again, one of them today?
One of them today.
So, Mackenzie, who might that be?
His name is Herbert Richard Baumeister.
Okay.
And that is how the internet told me to pronounce his name. Baumeister doesn't seem like a very scary name, but he was not a good man. So Herbert Richard Baumeister was born on April 7th, 1947.
A day after mom's birthday.
I know. He was born in Indianapolis, Indiana, and was the oldest of 4 children. His childhood was relatively normal until he reached his adolescent years.
As it seems to be.
Mm-hmm. And then he started to show antisocial tendencies, and by the time he was a teenager, he was diagnosed with schizophrenia. However, he didn't get any treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's no documentation that he got treatment after being diagnosed.
And this was, like, in the 50s?
Yeah, it would have been. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, of course, there's nothing.
He was in and out of college over the years, but he never graduated. He also held down multiple jobs. He was said to have a great work ethic. However, he exhibited extremely bizarre behavior. Wow, that's a lot of EXs. So, I looked up some of the odd things he did. A school friend of Herb's talked about that once he picked up a dead crow on his way to school and kept it and then placed it on his teacher's desk.
Ew. What right. would you do if you walked into school one day with a crow on your desk?
I would just walk right back out.
All right, no school today, guys.
So at one job that he was working at the local newspaper, and it was a job that people believe his father helped him get. His father was super important. He worked at, like, the local hospital.
Hmm.
Well-off guy. And one of the executives that worked there, worked at the paper, Gary Donna, claimed that Herb was sensitive about how others viewed him. He wanted approval from the higher-ups. He wanted to be accepted by others. But because of his odd behavior, it was hard for him to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And so Gary talks about one incident where Herb picked Gary and some friends up for a football game. And Gary and his friends, they were like with dates and stuff. And according to Gary, Herb picked them up in a hearse.
Okay.
And it was thought that he got it because of his dad working at the hospital.
Yeah.
And he had like flashing lights and he was speeding down the road. And apparently he was like laughing the entire time. And so obviously the passengers were a bit concerned.
Yes.
So another job that he had was with the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. Again, another job thought to have been secured by his father.
Mm-hmm.
And one year he sent around a Christmas card of him and another man in drag.
Okay.
And
there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
But sending that to coworkers is odd.
Yeah, as a Christmas card.
Yeah.
Because of his go-get-em attitude and his high intelligence, he was promoted to program director. And one would think that with this promotion would have some new professionalism. No, no. However, his odd behavior and antics became increasingly worse, and he was suspected of urinating on his boss's desk. No one knew for sure, but given his previous behavior, everyone did suspect him, and he did get fired from his job later on when he urinated on a letter that was addressed to the governor of
Indiana. Oh, my God.
So, small guy. In 1971, he married Julie Sater. I think that's how you say it. They were introduced by a mutual friend. They had three children together, Marie, Eric, and Emily. They were married for 25 years.
Oh, wow.
And Julie later commented on the fact that they only had sexual intercourse 6 times during their marriage.
Wow. And 3 of those to have children.
Mm-hmm. So after being fired from the BMV, he went and he worked at a local thrift shop. And after working there for a few years, Julie and Herb decided to open their own thrift shop. It's called Save-A-Lot.
Okay.
The business was so successful in the first year that they opened a second store. And the family eventually moved into a 4-bedroom Tudor-style home that came with an indoor pool and 18 acres of land.
Oh, wow. That sounds beautiful.
Mm-hmm. They called it the Fox Hollow Farms.
If you had a big house, would you name it?
No.
Oh, I was going to ask, what would you name it?
I mean,
I don't think I would either. I'm not creative enough to have, like, a fun name.
Right.
And like, I don't think
the only thing
do
I can
anymore.
Think of is Mackenzie Manor, but that's...
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah.
Welcome to Mackenzie Manor.
Yeah.
Cute.
Makes it sound, like, sophisticated, I guess. So, something to note is that 6 months after Julie and Herb got married, Herb's father committed Herb to a mental institution for 2 months. There was no reason as to why.
Has he, over all these years, has he gotten any help with, like, his mental health?
Besides the 2 months that he went to this institution? No.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So, and apparently didn't raise any concerns to his new wife because they were together for 25 years.
Okay.
In the early 1990s, if you lived in and around Indianapolis, you might see an article here and there about young gay men who were disappearing and were never to be seen again. Because this was part of the Bible Belt, these stories barely made headlines.
Oh, I didn't realize the Bible Belt went up that high.
Mm-hmm. And most people assumed that these men went to other cities that were more accepting of their way of life.
Yeah.
And the officers investigating these missing men were also very lethargic in pursuing answers.
Mm-hmm. Which kind of relates to mine in a way.
Hmm. It was not until a private investigator, Virgil Vandegrift, started putting all the facts together that these disappearances were taken seriously. So, Virgil was a well-respected private investigator. He is best known for investigating missing people. Vandegrift said, quote, "The way it works here in Indianapolis is that persons are not classified as missing until they are gone 24 hours. The case then goes to a district detective, and if they don't find them in 30 days, it travels to the Missing Persons Bureau for them to investigate. Now, to the general public, this seems like a lot of red tape and highly absurd. Parents don't want to wait to find out what happened to their kid, and wives don't want to wait to see what happened to their husbands. They come to me."
Oh.
Mm-hmm. In early June of 1994, great year.
You weren't born yet at that point.
I was.
I was alive on this earth.
I was.
You were forming.
Cooking. In early June of 1994, the mother of 28-year-old Alan Broussard came to Vandegrift to help her find her missing son. In his investigation, Vandegrift learned that Broussard had had some troubles in his life. He was known for being a heavy drinker and being in the gay community that was not accepting of his lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
Broussard was last seen leaving the gay bar Brothers. Vandegraaff passed out flyers, photos, asking if anyone had information about Broussard. And at first, Vandegrift did not suspect foul play. However, three events occurred that led Vandegrift to believe that Indianapolis had a serial killer in their midst. One, Vandegrift learned of several other disappearances involving gay men, all of whom had similar appearances to Alan Broussard. Vandegrift had discovered another disappearance the year before. In July of 1993, Jeff Jones, 31, seemed to have vanished from the area. His lifestyle and habits were very similar to the other missing men. And the latest disappearance was Roger Allen Goodlett, 34, who was last seen leaving a gay bar on 16th Street. And Goodlett was also similar in appearance, age, and lifestyle to the rest of the missing men. And they learned that Goodlett was last seen leaving the bar with another man. The description of the man was vague, but he was seen leaving in a light blue car with an Ohio license plate.
Mm.
So given all these factors, Vandegrift was convinced something larger was at play here. However, local police remain uninterested. Thankfully, that did not discourage the private investigator. He kept pursuing the leads and asked patrons of the local gay bars if they had any information. Luckily, in August, an informant came forward that had information that may help the investigator find the most recent of missing men, Roger Allen Goodlett. So, this informant, his name, Tony Harris. His name was changed.
Okay.
So, for anonymity purposes, I assume. So, Tony Harris knew of Goodlett from the local gay bar scene. He saw Vandegrift's poster asking for more information and felt he had something that could put some of the pieces together. Harris had tried going to the local police and FBI, but both had written him off as having a bad drug trip or being crazy. However, Harris came into contact with the suspect, and it is a miracle that Harris came out of it alive. So, here's what happened. Harris had seen the suspect in the bars before. He described him as tall, lanky, silent. Tony noticed him because he was staring intently at the missing poster of Goodlett.
Mm-hmm.
Harris said he had a gut feeling that this was the reason his friend was missing. Because Harris wanted to find some answers about his missing friend, he struck up a conversation with the man.
Okay.
Very brave.
I would not have done that. I just don't do that in general, so right. I wouldn't do it now.
Yeah. And the man introduced himself as Brian Smart, who claimed he was a landscape artist from Ohio. He said he was currently living in the house that he was landscaping for the new owners.
Mm-hmm.
And he invited Harris over for cocktails and a swim.
No.
Harris was hesitant, but decided to go with him.
No, never go with them.
And remember what Herb has in his house.
Mm-hmm.
Is an indoor swimming pool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So later they arrived at this large Tudor mansion. Harris said he could make out farm on the sign out front. Harris was led through the basement through the house to the basement, and he noticed that there was a subtle amount of clutter and noticed many mannequins around the room.
No, that is your one of your first signs to be like, absolutely not.
Oh, it gets crazier.
Oh, no.
So Brian noticed Harris staring at the mannequins, and he said, I quote, "I get lonely down here. They give me company."
Red flag number two.
Right. Brian had convinced Harris to go for a swim, and while in the pool, Brian started raving about choking someone during sex.
Third red flag.
As Brian carried on about—
Which, if that's your thing, that's totally fine.
Sure.
But knowing what this guy is, that's why it's not okay.
I think the mannequins would just—
That would be my first thing. I'd be like, I can't be here.
You know, like—
Yeah.
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 As Brian carried on about his asphyxiation desires, Harris became convinced that Brian had killed his friend Roger Goodlett.
Mm-hmm.
So, Brian convinced Harris to choke him using a hose, and while he did that, Brian partook in sexual acts.
Okay.
And at this point, Harris doubted that Brian was his real name, and he wanted to find out more about his missing friend. And he was also terrified.
Yeah.
And so he did whatever Brian told him to do because he was scared.
Mm-hmm.
And something to note, too, is that when I was looking through this research, Harris was saying that he thinks Brian was on something.
Yeah.
He had, like, tried to make them drinks. And Harris didn't accept the drink. Like, he didn't take
That's
it,
smart.
Which
yeah.
is good.
Yeah.
Because he said that when Brian, like, came back from— I don't know, getting the drinks or doing something, he seemed, like, way different, like, super hyper.
Mm-hmm.
Thought it might have been cocaine. So, yeah. So Harris let Brian choke him with the hose, and he lost consciousness for a few moments, but then he was shaken awake by Brian, and Brian was yelling at him, "You scared the shit out of me. You know you can die doing this. There have been accidents."
Accidents.
Mm-hmm. So feeling bold, Harris outright asked Brian if that was what happened to Roger Goodlett, asking Brian if there was others that this had happened to. And Brian just stared at Harris, seeming to be in a daze, possibly from the drugs. Mm-hmm. He only gave Harris a fool's grin. And eventually Brian fell asleep and Harris took this as an opportunity to do some digging.
I would have used this as an opportunity to leave.
He doubted that Brian was his real name or that the house they were in was the one that Brian was working on. He mm-hmm. went upstairs and he saw children's toys along with women's clothing. Harris tried to find Brian's wallet to learn his real name, but Brian woke up before he could find it. Right. As I've been reading this, like, my heart was like, right? I was like, oh my God, he's got to get out of there. So Harris was able to convince Brian to drive him back to town. And after dropping him off, Brian asked to see Tony again the following Wednesday at the 501 Club. So Harris was not sure of the exact location of the house because it was at night.
Yeah.
And all Vindegriff had to go on was the word farm.
Yeah.
On the sign out front.
Not too helpful.
And he hoped to catch this Brian Smart during his next meeting with Harris. However, Brian never showed up back at the bar mm-hmm. the next week. So something to note, if you're wondering why the wife and children were not there.
Of course, yes.
Julie frequently took the kids to visit her mother-in-law, so Herb's mom,
yeah.
and often without her because of work pressure. So he didn't go a lot because of the business that they had.
Interesting.
So they were gone a lot.
Yeah, a way to be out of the house, have yep. the house to himself.
Mm-hmm. So, more missing. So kind of given all of this, Vandergriff was then able to have enough to go to the police. And that's what he did. And Detective Mary Wilson was in charge of investigating missing persons, Jeff Jones from 1983. So the guy that Vandergriff had originally discovered.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that Wilson was also investigating several other disappearances that match Jeff Jones, Alan Broussard, and Alan Goodlett's description.
Yeah.
Richard Hamilton, 20, Johnny Bayer, 21, Alan Livingston, 28, and others going back to the early 1990s.
Jeez.
All of whom were gay men in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
So after hearing Harris's story, Wilson put plainclothes officers at the 501 Club and the Varsity and Our Place. I'm assuming those are local gay bars in the area.
Yeah.
They talked to the bartenders and patrons, trying to gain any information on the kidnapper. Wilson asked Harris if he could recall the license plate number of the car he was in. Harris and his friends continued to hang out at the bars in hopes of seeing Brian again to get his license plate number.
Yeah.
So even though the case had been taken over by the police, Vandergriff still continued to investigate the disappearance on his own. He sent one of his investigators, Bill Hilsey, to search the country suburbs for the house that Harris had described. So Hilsey found himself in front of a house with a long driveway and a sign out front that said Fox Hollow Farms.
Oh.
Remembering what Harris said about seeing a sign, Hilsey looked around the house for any clues that might indicate that it was the house that Harris was taken to.
Mm-hmm.
Vandegraaff had Hilsey take photos of the property, and when they showed it to Harris, he didn't think it was the house.
Oh, no. Mm-hmm.
He thought the driveway was shorter. Yeah.
Sir.
Meanwhile, Herb's life was starting to fall apart. His business was failing and his wife was threatening to divorce him. And so his mood was turning darker and more strange as time went on. So. It had been a year since Virgil Vandergriff and Detective Mary Wilson had begun their search for Brian Wilson. Vandergriff said, quote, whatever leads we could have taken went nowhere, Vandergriff states. Personally, I don't feel there was a whole lot of cooperation between the police and the Hamilton County officials, whose attitude I sense was one of these folks here are rich and therefore above suspicion. But in truth, there weren't many hard leads, so we couldn't push too far.
That actually is super annoying, though, because that is a legit thing. Like, mm-hmm. if you're rich enough, you are above suspicion.
Oh, for sure. And it didn't help that these men were also gay.
Yeah, no, absolutely didn't help.
This investigation was not taken as seriously as it should have been. So finally, on the evening of August 29th, 1995, Brian Smart decided it was safe enough to return to the gay bar scene. Tony Harris was at the Varsity Lounge when he saw Brian Smart enter the bar. Harris chatted with Smart for a bit and was able to get the license plate number and gave it to Detective Wilson. And when Wilson ran the license plate, the car was registered to a man named Herbert Baumeister.
Finally.
Who lived in Westfield, Indiana. They also discovered that Herbert lived in an estate called Fox Hollow Farms with his wife and children. And the house also had a swimming pool in the basement.
Yep.
So
I was thinking, like, nowadays it would be so much easier to look because you could go on Zillow.
Right.
Like, let me see the inside of this house.
Yeah, exactly. And then you could just show pictures and right? say, is this where you were? Wilson and her boss, Lieutenant Thomas Green, approached Herb at his store on Washington Street, and they told him point blank that he was a suspect in their investigation of these missing men. And they asked Herb if they could search his home, to which he refused and told the police to contact his lawyer. Not to be dissuaded, though, Wilson and Green tried their luck with Herb's wife, Julie. Herb told Julie that he was being investigated for theft and to not let anyone search their home. But Wilson and Green explained the real reason for their search, and Julie was shocked into silence. Yeah. However, the information didn't change her mind, and she still did not let the police in her home.
I mean, because in all fairness, like, she doesn't think he did anything wrong, you know?
I mean, I wouldn't want to suspect that my husband did that.
Yeah, and also at the same time, you're like, I don't want random cops searching my house for a random reason.
So because of the investigation, things between Herb and Julie began to grow sour. At one point, Julie even blamed Detective Wilson for their troubles at home, saying, quote, "The police are not coming to my house," she screamed, tearing through things, upsetting my children, all on the word of a psycho named Tony Harris, whom my husband never even heard of.
See, so she's getting a completely different story from him.
Vandegrift blamed the county police for the long wait, saying, quote, "Mary Wilson, who wanted a search warrant, was unable to get one issued because Hamilton County was out of her jurisdiction. Hamilton County, in the meantime, would not cooperate." Why? Who knows? Whether it was their timidity? Hamilton County, in the meantime, would not cooperate. Why? Who knows? Whether it was their timidity to confront an otherwise... I can't read. An otherwise law-abiding citizen until they had conclusive proof, or whether they really didn't believe Bowmeister was guilty, I don't know. But it might have saved a lot of trouble, and the 6 months wait it eventually took for Julie to finally open her backyard for inspection. So, because the home life had become very intolerable for Julie, their business was failing, and Herb's mood was getting worse. Both of them filed for divorce, and feeling no loyalty to Herb anymore, Julie finally let the police search their estate in June of 1996. So, side note, back in 1994, Herb's son, Eric, was playing in the backyard and had discovered a partially buried human skeleton. And he told his mom. And what he had, he told his mom what he had found, and Julie asked Herb about the remains, and Herb said that his father used them in his research, since his father was a doctor, and he found it while cleaning and decided to bury the bones, and Julie believed him. So, this is where it gets kind of dark and really creepy. So local policeman Captain Tom Anderson and Detective Jeff Markham, they both highly doubted that Wilson and Green would find what they were looking for, and Julie pointed police in the direction where her son had found the skeleton. And looking at the yard, everything looked in place. The police started searching in patches of dirt, and they soon discovered a bone about a foot long, and it looked like the bone had been burned, and they were not sure yet if the bone was human, but they continued their search. As they continued their search, they soon discovered that what they thought were pebbles and rocks turned out to be pieces of bone fragments. And they were spread all across the yard.
I'm already cold in our house, and now I'm, like, extra cold.
The children had been playing in this yard, having no idea what they were walking on.
Oh, that's so creepy.
It gets worse. they turned all the evidence over to forensic anthropologist Stephen Naraki. Naraki concluded that the bone fragments were indeed human and that they had all been burned. Police, off-duty police, fireman Stephen Naraki and his two assistants, close to 60 volunteers, helped with the uncovering of 5,500 bone fragments.
Oh my gosh.
All across the 18-acre plot of land.
Damn.
However, their search did not end there. Neighbors informed the police of finding bone fragments in a section of land that separates their houses, and when investigators went to search this ditch, they found numerous human ribs, spines, and vertebrae. By the time they finished their search, they had found the bodies of 11 men, and at the time, they were only able to identify four of the bodies.
Oh, that's sad.
So they identified Roger Allen Goodlett, Steve Hale, Richard Hamilton, Manuel Resendez.
Just say it all fast, it won't sound good.
Okay. And Manuel Resendez.
There you go.
They were not able to identify the other seven bodies found at the estate yet. So, in the end, Herb was currently living with his mother, or visiting with his mother, with their son, And he had no idea that any of this was going on back at his house. And of course, Julie is now freaked out because mm-hmm. her son's with him. And so she's scared for his safety.
Yeah.
And so police were able to get a court order ordering Herb to turn his son over to police. And Herb just kind of assumed that his wife was being difficult about, like, the divorce and stuff.
Okay.
So he still didn't suspect anything.
Yeah.
So then Herb called his brother from a small town in Michigan asking for some money. Herb's brother notified the police, and they asked him to tell Herb that he was being investigated and needed to talk to the police. Mm-hmm. Herb did not listen to his brother, but instead made his way into Canada. And on July 3rd, Herb shot himself in his car in Ontario, Canada. He left a 3-page note stating the reason for the suicide was because of his failing marriage and businesses. But he did not make any confession of the crimes he's being accused of. As investigators continued their search of the estate, they discovered the basement and the mannequins from Harris's story.
Uh-huh.
They also discovered a hidden video camera that they assumed was Herb was using to record his victims.
Ew.
Yep. It was later discovered that while he was in Canada, Herb had been questioned by police because he was sleeping. They found him sleeping in his car.
Yeah.
And the police person who had talked to him saw that there was tapes, I think, like, in the back with a bunch of stuff. But he said he was traveling, so they just let him go.
Yeah.
But then when they found him, like, his dead body after he killed himself, the tapes weren't there.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Now, the story goes on. So, obviously, they assume that he is responsible for all the murders of the people that they found.
Would make sense,
on
yes.
his land. Right. Well, they also think he's responsible for more than just them. So, and this is where, when I was doing this research, this is where I thought I maybe have heard of him before. So he was suspected of being responsible for a series of murders that occurred off of Interstate 70. The interstate connected Ohio and Indiana. The bodies of 9 men were found nude and strangled, and these murders have taken place in the late 1980s and ended in the early 1990s. Mm-hmm. Julie gave investigators information regarding Herb's travel during that time. One eyewitness identified Herb as the man who left with his friend Michael Riley, who was found killed the next morning.
Yeah.
And so they called him, like, the I-70 Strangler.
Oh!
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yep, I have heard that.
Yeah. So the receipts that Julie provided investigators showed that Herb was in the areas at the time the bodies were found. Bodies stopped being discovered right around the time that Julie and Herb purchased their 18-acre estate.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
So they were able to identify more of the victims. I found this article that was published in 2020. Most of the other information I found was from 2019 or earlier.
Yeah.
They were able to identify 8 of the 11 bodies.
Wow.
Because of DNA. So they were able to confirm Roger Goodlett, Stephen Hale, Richard Hamilton, Manuel Resendez, Mike Kern, Johnny Bayer, Alan Broussard, and Jeff Jones. And the article also stated that ghost hunters will often go to his estate because of paranormal activity in the house.
Oh my gosh, look at you adding 2 things into one story.
I know. They said that doors would fly open and objects would move. One person claimed to have seen a legless man wearing a red shirt.
Ooh.
Unfortunately, justice was never given to these 20 men when Herb took his life. Thankfully, the families of the men were able to put their sons and brothers and friends to rest. So it's not 100% certain that he is the I-70 Strangler, but based on the evidence they found, it all points to him.
It sounds pretty convincing.
And I do wonder that if these men had not been gay, if they had not been deemed as high risk by police, mm-hmm. if justice would have been served sooner.
Well, we saw that with Jeffrey Dahmer. Mm-hmm. He did the same thing where he would, you know, go out and find gay men mm-hmm. and bring them back, and the cops would do absolutely nothing about it.
I just watched a documentary before I came over here about – I watched that one, but then it was also this guy in England who was a serial killer, and mm-hmm. it was the same thing, like – picking up gay men, young gay men,
mm-hmm.
and they were deemed as runaways and things like that. It took a while for it to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
They even talked in the documentary about the prejudice that was against these men.
It's awful.
And how it impacted the investigation.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So even the local police doubted Mary Wilson, who was an investigator, mm-hmm. and that was part of the reason why things were stonewalled, because they doubted her. And they didn't really put any effort into any of these missing people. And had they given it the same attention they might have given it to a straight person, then maybe justice could have been served.
A lot earlier, too. Wow.
So that is Herbert Richard Baumeister.
Well, good job, Mackenzie.
Thank you.
Wow. Yeah, that's awful.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a wild one.
Yeah. Just when I thought it, like, I was so engrossed in research and just reading everything and trying to figure out, like, what to include. And, oh, my gosh, there's so much.
I mean, especially with, like, him potentially being, like, the I-70 strangler, too. Like, that's wild because that's one that I've heard before.
Exactly. And that's kind of what – when I was reading it, I was, like – you know, obviously trying to find something that's not quite as well known, and I had never heard of him before. But then when I read more about him possibly being the I-70 strangler, that I was like, that kind of sounds...
That, like, rings a bell, yeah.
Yeah, sounds familiar. So, yeah.
Wow. Well, good job.
Thank you.
All right, so the case I'm going to cover today hits a little bit closer to home for me personally. So when Nora and I started this podcast, we joined a ton of different Facebook groups to, like, you know, figure out what we were doing and kind of get that help from people when we needed it.
Yeah.
And so one of the groups we were part of discusses true crime and whatnot and podcasts. So I was scrolling one day and I came upon a post from a woman who her son had been killed and very recently. And she was looking for someone to help cover her son's case and to get the word out to just find out what happened to him and hopefully get justice for him. And she was just reaching out to a ton of different the whole group to just be like, if you have a podcast, like, I would really appreciate if you cover his case. So of course I messaged her and I said, I would, you know, I want to cover this case. So she's hoping that by people sharing Alex's story, his story can get out there and maybe hopefully she can get the answer she's looking for about what happened to her son. So I reached out to her and I told her I wanted to help share his case. And I spoke to her on Friday as well, like this past Friday. And I was like, hey, I have all the notes for the case. Like, is there anything you want me to include? Anything you don't want me to include? Like, please let me know. And she is just the sweetest person. And so she sent me a ton of information. So, yeah, I want to cover his case and just do a really good job. Okay, so before I start, I want to give a shout out to Beyond the Rainbow podcast. So I listened to their episode on Alex, and they gave, like, a lot of really good information on the case. And I also like what their podcast stands for and why they cover the cases they do. So Beyond the Rainbow obviously is LGBTQ, and they focus on, you know, those who have gone missing or who have been murdered who are in that, like, who identify as LGBTQ. So Alexander Blake Van Dalsen was born on December 20th, 1999, under a different name. Though he was born prematurely, Alex was described as being a happy kid. By age 14, Alex came out as lesbian, then by the age of 15, decided that he knew he was male, so he was planning on transitioning.
Okay.
He started going by the name Alexander. So I didn't want to use his dead name, so that's why I didn't mention it.
Yeah.
So I'll just refer to him as Alex now and throughout my story. So when Alex turned 18, he began the transition. At this point, he hadn't started with any steroids, injections, or surgeries, but was actively identifying as being male.
Okay.
Beyond the Rainbow mentioned that this is a big first part of the whole transition process, the actively identifying as the other gender. So what I love to hear was that Alex had many supportive friends and a very supportive family, minus his biological dad. So Alex's mother was incredibly supportive of the decision Alex was making. And even offered to help pay for the transition when the time came.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it really is. She just seemed so sweet.
Yeah.
But Alex said that this was his thing. He wanted to do it on his own, and he wanted to pay for it completely. He graduated from McCuffian High School. Growing up, Alex enjoyed rollerblading, hiking, spending time with his friends and family, seeing old trucks and old cars, and just watching the sky. He was also an advocate for peace and equality, even without really knowing that he was being an advocate. So he would attend peaceful protests. He was very active during the whole, like, Black Lives Matter movement, especially after the George Floyd incident. He would also post statistics that looked into how many police are involved in the deaths of those in custody. He truly cared about others and wanted everyone to experience equality and peace, and he just sounded like a really great guy. So he's remembered as always loving to make people happy and always being there to help someone if help was needed. But Alex also suffered from depression and anxiety. He did know this was something he was dealing with, and he did actively seek out help, was seeing a therapist, and was also taking medication. He had such a good understanding of when he needed help that in October of 2020, he tried to check himself into the Sycamore Mental Health Facility. He knew they offered group sessions, and he felt that it would be more beneficial to him than the one-on-one therapy he was already having with his therapist. But the Sycamore facility was hesitant to accept him at first, as they didn't believe Alex really qualified for needing to be there. He didn't seem to be in crisis at the time, but this prompted Alex to reveal that he had, in fact, thought about suicide recently, so he was admitted. I think he was there for like a couple days to a week, maybe.
So like, what would they consider being in crisis? Like if he's asking to be checked in, like why would they turn him away?
I don't know. Huh. I feel like there's such a crack in the mental health in the United States where, you know, you could be actively needing help and it's just awful. There's not enough resources. There's not enough people.
Yeah.
So I just feel like they didn't see him as like, you know, wanting to do it at that exact moment or something,
right,
you know?
Right, right.
But Alex was always very open about his struggles and what he was facing and was always upfront about who he was going through. One incident that I heard about that happened to Alex in October of 2019 was that he had been robbed at gunpoint.
Oh, my God.
He wasn't physically harmed, but this event definitely took a toll on him.
Yeah.
Like, as a person. And to make matters worse, it wasn't a random incident. This robbery had been set up by a friend, and I say friend in quotes, of Alex's. So that just adds to the emotional and mental toll of this incident.
It was set up by a friend?
Apparently, yeah. Apparently the friend, like, set up this robbery to, I don't know
why.
Was
it supposed to be a joke? Like,
I have no idea.
What awful person does
that? I didn't hear much more about it, but I wanted to include it.
Yeah.
So Alex was also very active on social media, as many 21-year-olds are. Mm-hmm. Beyond the Rainbow read some of Alex's Facebook posts during their episode. So the posts really helped to shine some light on who Alex was. He seemed sweet, caring, and really wanted to get better and get a better handling on his depression and anxiety.
Good for him.
In his posts, he would also mention how his main goal was to make others happy and to make others smile no matter what he was personally going through. Though young, Alex suffered from arthritis when it was cold out and had chronic asthma. His asthma could get so bad that even on a short walk, Alex would have to have his inhaler with him because even those short walks could get tough.
Yeah.
So at the time of this incident, Alex was 21 years old and living in Lafayette, Indiana. So sadly, our story begins in February. February is cold in Indiana, and this February was no different. The recorded temperature was 21 degrees Fahrenheit, which is negative 6 Celsius, but felt like 4 degrees Fahrenheit or negative 15 Celsius with the wind chill. On February 3rd, 2021, for unknown reasons, Alex left his house at 11:44 p.m. He didn't tell anyone where he was planning on going or why he was leaving at this time.
Did he live with anybody?
He lived with his parents.
Okay.
So he had, I think it was his mom, I don't think his dad was in the picture, and his sister.
Okay.
And at the time of this all happening, it was him, his sister, and I think his aunt or something in the house.
Okay.
So the last sighting of him was from the security camera at his house, showing him walking to the end of the driveway, turning and walking away. And like I said, it was cold. That night, the temperatures dropped to about 20 degrees, and there was a foot of snow on the ground from a previous snowfall. And Alex definitely wasn't dressed for the weather. He was wearing sweatpants with a pair of jeans over them, a long-sleeve shirt, a light black hoodie, tan leather boots, and a beanie. So definitely not the right clothes to be going outside in the middle of the night in below, like, freezing weather.
Yeah.
Alex also didn't bring anything with him. He didn't take his car, his keys, his phone, his glasses.
So he literally just walked out.
Or his inhaler.
Oh, God.
So remember how I said Alex had asthma?
Yeah,
so even
on
short walks in nice weather, he would have needed that and brought his inhaler.
Right.
So there's no way he would have gone out in the cold weather on a walk without it. And I can only assume how bad asthma can get in the cold.
Sure.
So at 2 a.m., Alex's parents returned home after work. Probably seeing Alex's car still in the driveway, they went to bed, sure that Alex was inside sleeping.
Yeah.
The next morning, February 4th, 2021, Alex's mother, Jennifer, woke up and noticed that Alex wasn't actually home, but she wasn't concerned. She assumed Alex was spending time with his girlfriend at her place, where he usually was when he wasn't home.
Mm-hmm.
But not much later, Alex's girlfriend arrived at the Van Dalsen household after she had been unable to get a hold of Alex. Jennifer was at work at this point and received a phone call from Alex's girlfriend, Genesis, informing her that her son, Alex, wasn't home and no one could get a hold of him. Immediately upon getting this call, Jennifer left work to search for him. The moment she arrived home, around 10:03 p.m., she worked very late.
Yeah.
She called 911 and reported her son as missing. She was informed that an officer would be dispatched to help her file the report. But something weird that was found when they returned home. So like I mentioned, Alex left without his phone, wallet, or keys. All of these were found in his room. He also had a lined sheet of paper lying on his desk that read, quote, "Please give back to Genesis, her journal, boxers, house key, bracelet, anything else she has here," end quote. Genesis's number was also written three times on this piece of paper. So no officers ended up replying to the initial 911 call.
Why?
So Jennifer believes that they didn't show up because in the past, they had been to the house a few times to do well-being checks on Alex, like to, you know.
Right.
If you suffer from mental health, sometimes it's something that you do.
Sure.
And they had, in one of the reports I read, they said that they didn't show up because they've already responded to these type of calls at the house. And Jennifer was like, no, you haven't, because he's never been missing.
Yeah.
So she believes they assumed his disappearance wasn't a big deal and that he would be back soon.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So at 11:30 p.m., she called 911 again and was told the same thing, that an officer would be dispatched to her location. So finally, a little after midnight, so over 30 minutes later, a sheriff showed up and the missing persons report was filed. So right here, I want to take a little pause to explain a few things about the Tippecanoe County Sheriff's Department. On a website called policescorecard.org, you can select a state and the county you want to look to and look at the scorecard for that certain sheriff's department.
Oh, interesting.
It's actually really interesting to go on. So out of a score of 100%, the Tippecanoe County Sheriff's Department had a score of 47.
Oh my God.
Mackenzie, if one of your students got a 47 out of 100, what would their score be?
An F.
Thank you. So this score is also based on four different sections of the scorecard. So their police funding got a 66%. Police accountability got a 29%.
Oh my God.
Police violence had a 44%. And approach to law enforcement had a 58%. So this is like the arrest rate for low-level offenses, which was 49%. Homicide solved, 67%. And racial disparities in drug arrests, which was 49%. So really not a great sheriff's department.
No.
And we are already seeing that so early in this case, and it does not get better.
Especially because they didn't even go to the house.
So during the family search, they made sure to hang up missing persons flyers as well. The next day, on February 5th, a retired officer, Janet Winslow, who had a canine, came to Alex's house to investigate. A retired officer. Not a current officer. Yeah. A retired officer.
Yeah.
Two county police officers did accompany her to the Van Dalsen's residence. The dog began its search by smelling something of Alex's first. It then started sniffing around, and pretty quickly the dog caught whiff of something and took off. The dog started to lead the officer in the direction that Alex had been seen walking on the security camera. The dog followed the scent for about a mile when suddenly it stopped and was able to pick up another scent. Which is odd.
Yeah.
Which makes me think if it's on a road, it's because they were on that road until a certain point and then they were gone.
What do you mean picked up another scent?
A car. He just wasn't able to pick up Alex's scent.
Oh, I see.
So he followed it for a mile down the road, and then just the scents were gone.
Yeah.
Which makes me think, potentially a car came or...
Yeah.
That was my first thought when I read that, at least. So the retired officer who had the dog had a friend named Sean Hennaday. Sean Hennaday had a heat thermal camera on a drone that he owned. So they said he would use this drone to look for Alex. So I guess pretty much what happened was... Sean Hennaday had his drone, and he was like, okay, because you guys can't find Alex anymore after this mile search, I'll search this 5 mile radius to see what my drone can pick up.
Yeah.
So he said that he found information on the drone, and he was gathering the information to pass it on to law enforcement. Alex's mom reached out to him and asked if she could be clued in on what was found, what was passed to law enforcement.
Sure.
So Hennaday said that, yes, once he, you know, gathered all of the information together and passed on to law enforcement, he would hand it over to her. So he passes it on. Jennifer reaches out again, and he's like, oh, yeah, I'm finishing it up. Like, you know, let me wait till law enforcement gets back to me, kind of something like that.
Why can't he just give – why does he have to wait?
So he keeps giving this runaround to her. Soon enough, he just stopped responding to her messages until he finally blocked her. So literally, we have no explanation for why this happened. Jennifer has – no idea why Sean Hennaday will not give her the information, and even Janet, the retired officer, has reached out to Sean and has got nothing.
That's bizarre.
Yeah. So not only did this drone person ignore Jennifer, but no matter how many times she asked, the police would not give her any information at all about their search for Alex or for what was found on the drone.
What?
But less than a week later, at approximately 1 p.m. on February 9th, 2021, Alex's body was found on Breckenridge Street. A city worker who drove a snowplow had been working in a remote area on a trail near a railroad clearing the snow. As he was doing this, in the snow a little ways off, he noticed a pair of boots sticking out of the snow. He immediately called the cops. So they did show up this time, but I think it still took a little bit of time for them to get there. So this is the part of the story where things just go from bad to even worse in terms of police work. So Alex's body was found in a very peculiar position. The body was on its back, with legs crossed at the ankles, and his hands were at the sides of him by his waist. But one of the police reports that I read said that Alex's left hand was inside of the pocket of his sweatshirt. A pink and black camo-colored semi-automatic 9mm with a purple handle was found under Alex's right elbow.
I'm sorry, give me that description again.
A pink and black camo-colored semi-automatic 9mm handgun with a purple handle.
How do you even get a gun like that?
But it's a pretty unique gun.
That is very unique.
It was found under his right elbow. And due to it being so cold outside, the gun had actually frozen to his arm and his waist.
Oh, wow.
And on the right and left sides of his head were an entry and exit wound of a bullet. Some blood was seen on the left side of his head, and some had pooled in the beanie he was wearing. But an interesting note here, in the reports and crime scene notes, no blood spatter was reported.
What does that mean?
So blood spatter is, you know, if you're hit with something or you're shot with something, your blood will go places.
Right. No, I know what blood spatter is, but...
Yeah,
what
so none was found.
So that means he wasn't shot there. Got it.
Potentially.
Interesting.
So Mr. Snowplow Man was obviously questioned.
Mr. Snowplow Man.
I have his name, but I felt like I didn't want to include it. So he was obviously questioned, but was ruled out as having no connection to Alex's death at all.
Right.
He did provide an important piece of information to the police, though. He told police that he had seen footprints near the body, but stated that they must have been there for a little while, as they had been snowed over a bit with the recent snow that had come through.
Interesting.
The police said that they would look into these prints, but guess what? They never did. They said it would be useless to do so.
What?
Uh-huh. I feel like this is a huge piece of information. Like, even if it's a partial print or something, like, shoe prints have helped catch multiple killers.
Yeah.
The Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez, is the first person who pops into my mind when I think of shoe imprints. Mm-hmm. Like, that's one of the main clues that helped them find Richard Ramirez was because of shoe prints outside of people's windows. So at first, the police didn't have an ID on the body that they had just found, but it was soon determined that this body fit the description down to the clothing of the missing person posters that had been hung up around town. Alex's body was found at 1 p.m. that day.
Wait a minute. They identified him based on the missing persons poster, not their information about him?
Yeah. That's how one person, like, recognized him. Was like, oh, I've seen these pictures. Like, you know.
Wow.
Yes. So, his body was found at 1 p.m. that day, but police didn't notify his family of this discovery until 4:15 p.m. So, I get it takes a little bit of time, but, like, not that long, especially when someone has already filed a missing persons report. And about the location where the body had been found, that remote trail, that area was almost 10 miles from Alex's house.
That's far.
That is far.
In the middle of the night, cold, and he has asthma. There's no way he walked there.
Exactly. So when Alex was found and when it was determined how far away he had been, his mother said the exact same thing. She said there was absolutely no way he walked that far in this cold of weather.
Nobody would walk that far.
No. The police even, I don't think I mentioned it later, but they didn't continue doing a lot of investigations because they hadn't been dressed for the cold. But Alex hadn't been dressed for the cold, so of course he didn't walk that far. And he had never been able to walk that far, especially with his, like, without his inhaler if he had bad asthma. So I can't say for sure, but I would assume that really cold temperatures only make asthma worse and make it harder to breathe. Oh. And there's a part I read in one of the police records where the cop was like, I understand he has asthma and you say it's hard for him to walk that far, but, like, I teach, I'm a coach and some of my kids have asthma and they're still able to run. And one of my other cop friends, he's able to do our physical fitness test and he has asthma. So I'm just saying, asthma doesn't make it that hard.
I hate when other people try to tell you what's wrong with you.
Right? And it's like, that's great for your friend. Right. That's great for the kids who don't have it that hard. That doesn't mean everyone's asthma is that easily controlled.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I read that part. I was reading this the other day and I had Joe on the couch with me. And I'm just there like, oh my God. And that's ridiculous. Joe's like, what is happening? I was like, let me tell you. Yeah. So without any further investigation, like I said, Alex's cause of death was ruled as a suicide.
What?
Uh-huh. In the subsequent reports that came out about the case, Alex's dead name was used, and he was misgendered multiple times.
Oh, my God.
But I guess in a small way in their defense, there were times when he was gendered correctly, though it shouldn't have been hard and should have been correct from the beginning. So like I said, I read the police reports that Alex's mom had sent over to me. They started out the report using Alex's dead name and incorrect pronouns, but then they made note of his preferred pronouns and his preferred name.
Oh, that's good.
So that's how they started to refer to him in that report.
Okay.
But they filed the report under his dead name. It's just, like, that's not what he identifies as. So, I don't know. And, like, as I kept reading through the reports, they would say she a lot. And I was like, it's not that hard.
Right.
It's not hard to do
Literally taking off one letter.
Right. The police were easily able to say suicide and stick with that ruling after learning that Alex had, in fact, been suffering from depression.
I figured that they would go there with that.
Uh-huh. So police ruled it as a suicide, but ended up passing the case off to the sheriff's department. They closed the case on their end and pretty much wiped their hands of Alex's case. After they passed the case off, they got word that near where the body had been found was an abandoned car that had been stuck in the snow. The police sort of did their job here and interviewed a man and a woman, the people who the car was registered to. The man and woman both had different stories for why the car was there.
Interesting.
The woman said that her boyfriend had wanted to smoke, so they pulled over for him to smoke and they ended up getting stuck. The man's story was quite different, though.
Why would you pull over to smoke?
It wasn't a cigarette.
Oh.
Yes. So the man's story went that he said his girlfriend had gotten herself stuck. By herself, called him to come help her, and he ended up getting the car more stuck. So not even similar stories in any way.
No.
So though hearing two very different stories, the police bought the story, which one they bought is unknown, but they determined this car wasn't involved in the case. The case also belonged to the sheriff's department at this point, so they, of course, didn't look into it any further because it wasn't really their problem.
So what's the difference between it belonging to the sheriff's department versus the police?
I don't know 100%, but I feel like it's just the jurisdictions and maybe what powers they have, because I feel like the police wouldn't have as much authority kind of as the sheriff's. Yeah. I could be completely wrong. I don't know, but that's kind of what it seems like to me.
Okay.
So the sheriffs also concluded that Alex's death had been a suicide. I'm sure a lot of that came from the fact that the cops had already ruled it as one first. The idea was confirmed in their minds after reading some of Alex's journals where he detailed the struggles he was facing with his mental health. Mm. Apparently, one of the journal entries, dated before he went missing, mentioned and implicated that he wanted to leave and not return. Those notes were admitted as evidence. So the family was told that Alex's cause of death had been suicide, that there had been no immediate signs of trauma on the body, but that more information would be available after the autopsy was completed. The family clearly had not been told about the gunshot wound at this point.
Yeah.
The family actually didn't find out Alex's actual cause of death until right before the funeral, when the funeral director called the family and asked if they wanted an open casket. That is when they found out that he had actually died of a gunshot wound to the head. The funeral director, Frank, even apologized to the family, saying that he hates to be the one who has to tell the family what happened to Alex.
Oh my God.
I know. So obviously the family asked how it was possible that the police said that there was no trauma to the body when there was clearly a gunshot wound, which is considered trauma. So what
they
found...
They should have lied.
Yes, absolutely. So what I found suspicious and sketchy on the police's part, in one of the police reports, it's clearly listed that there was trauma to the head. Like, it was put into the report that there was trauma. So why was this not communicated to the family?
Yeah.
Why did they have to find out through the funeral director? Why did the police not have the decency to tell the family? Like, no matter how hard it would have been to hear what happened, it is their right to know.
Well, right. And that, too. Like, what about this fancy gun?
Yeah. Well, we will get to the gun.
That's okay.
So after the funeral, when the coroner report came back, it was again and confirmed to have been a suicide.
Yeah.
In their eyes. The coroner had seen the bullet wound, where it had been, the entry and exit wounds, and how the bullet's pathway went across, like straight across from one side to the other. The entry and exit wounds were, of course, measured by the coroner. The entrance wound was claimed to have been on the right side of Alex's head, measuring at 6.5 by 5 centimeters. The exit wound was said to be on the left side of Alex's head, measuring at 1.5 by 1 centimeter. So it's saying the entrance wound was a lot bigger than the exit wound, okay?
Okay.
But with logic and the measurements, the entrance wound would have had to have been on the left side, and exit wound would have had to be on the right side, because with gunshot wounds, the exit wound is always, always bigger than the entrance wound.
That would make sense.
Yes. So the coroner's report does not make sense that it would have gone in the right and left through the left if the entrance wound was bigger.
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Like, with just logic and how the world works, that's not how that works.
Yeah.
So let me...
It should be something that a coroner should know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let me explain this a bit and talk about the issues here. So the coroner said the bullet entered on the right side. Like I said above, that isn't possible given the size of the entry and exit wounds. Mm-hmm. But this way, though the wound signs were impossible, would have fit the sheriff's narrative. Mm. If Alex had completed suicide, he would have most likely used his right hand, as he was right-handed. Mm-hmm. This is why they're trying to say that the entry wound was on the right.
Ah.
But again, based on measurements and physics, we can pretty much say that the entrance wound was on the left. Alex also had bad wrists, as he had
arthritis,
as I mentioned, which only got worse in the cold weather. So the probability of him actually being able to hold the gun up, aim, and fire with his wrists is very unlikely. Also, any gun you shoot is going to have a recoil. No matter how slight, it's going to have a recoil.
Yeah.
The coroner said that the bullet wound went straight from one side to the other in a line. Mm-hmm. If Alex had actually been the one to shoot the gun, the recoil, no matter how slight, would have caused an upward angle for the bullet, not a straight across line.
Yeah.
So it is believed that the coroner just went along with what the sheriff said happened to Alex, a sheriff who wasn't even at the crime scene at the time when it happened. So after hearing the coroner's, in my opinion, incorrect report, looking at Alex's journal, knowing his mental health journey, and knowing he was on medication only further solidified the sheriff's in concluding that Alex's death was suicide.
I mean, I get it, but it's also like, it doesn't seem like they're doing their due diligence to...
And why do we think they're not doing their due diligence?
Mm. Gee, I wonder.
Uh-huh. So there are still more things that didn't add up to what happened to Alex. First, we have the fact that it was originally ruled a suicide, like I've mentioned 1,000 times. Mm-hmm. Then Alex is found with the bullet wound, and we went into all of that. And no GSR test had been done on Alex. A GSR test is a gunshot residue test that is conducted in a case where a firearm is involved. This test detects the presence of certain chemicals that are left on a person's skin or clothing or other nearby surfaces when a gun is fired.
Would it still be, like, if he did in fact shoot himself, would it still be left on his hands at that
Most
point?
Likely. It can usually come off if someone washes their hands or brushes it on their clothing, like a few different ways.
Right.
But if he is said to be alone, it's going to be somewhere on him.
Okay. I just didn't know because of, like, the snow, too.
Yeah, it would still... There's ways that it would be there.
You'd think they'd still test for it anyway.
Yes. So this kind of test is also considered to be reliable and can be admitted as evidence in a case. But the police said that it is actually no longer performed and they don't do it anymore.
Why?
So in one of the reports, it says they don't do it because it's not reliable and because it's not able to be used in, like, court records or whatever, like, admitted as evidence in a case. But online, I did read that it could be, so I don't really know. There's a little discrepancy there. But they say they don't...
A lot of discrepancies.
Yeah, but they say they don't do those tests any longer, so... I don't know. So I talked about how a gun had been found at the scene. So the weird part about this is that it had been found under him. Not next to Alex, but under him.
There's no way he would fall on the gun.
Thank you! So you would think that the police would have tested the gun, again, maybe doing the GSR test to see if it had been shot, but maybe testing it for fingerprints? They did nothing. No tests of any kind on the gun. And actually, as of now, it said that there's no inventory of this gun. The police who closed the case were the last ones to have it, so why wouldn't they have passed it on to the sheriff's department, right, who is now taking over the case? Also with this gun, like I said, no test had been run, so no GSR test. They didn't check to see who it was registered. They didn't check to see who bought it. They just assumed it was Alex's. But according to Alex's family, he didn't own a gun.
Right.
But in the police's report, apparently Genesis, his girlfriend, had told the police that Alex had shown her a handgun he owned that he had recently purchased that had a purple handle. But Genesis was unable to locate it after he went missing. But the police report didn't say what the gun looked like other than it potentially had a purple handle, but they didn't talk about the camo design or anything like that.
Right.
Police also claimed that they had searched the area where the gun had been found with a metal detector for 2 hours looking for a shell casing that should have been present. Yeah. If you shoot a gun... There is a shell casing.
Especially if you're dead, you're not going to pick it up.
Mm-hmm. Furthermore, no blood spatter was found, like I mentioned. So the two things that are wrong with this, if it was a suicide, as the police are saying, the shell casing would 100% still be there.
Yeah.
There would be no second person who could have removed it, so it should have been found near him. Also, head wounds bleed a lot.
Yeah.
So there would 100% have been blood at the scene had Alex been the one to shoot himself.
And there wasn't.
There was some in his beanie and some on the side of his head.
But
none anywhere else. And there would have been blood somewhere else if that is what happened. There was snow on the ground, so red blood, snow.
Right.
You're going to notice it.
It would have been hard to miss.
Exactly. Police also said about the position that Alex's body was found in that it did look like it had been posed, but later they changed their opinion to say when further details come to light. But the police never said what these additional details were and never provided those additional details to Alex's family.
Hmm.
And on top of all of that, the clothes Alex had been wearing that day had eventually been thrown away. So again, no test had been performed on them.
They threw it away?
Uh-huh. The clothes were thrown away. The 9mm handgun that had been found didn't have tests conducted on it. Like, they just...
They didn't even try to see who it was registered to?
No. So it just sounds like really shit police work.
Yeah.
And many speculate, and what Alex's mom truly believes, is that Alex was picked up by someone... Could be why the scent was stopped, killed at a different location than dumped in the area where his body was finally found. Because no shell casings, no blood, the dogs lost the scent. Alex's mother
was 10 miles from home.
And he was 10 miles from home. Alex's mother also believed that the case wasn't investigated further because Alex was transgender.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And the media also didn't really report on this case, and Alex's mother also believes that was for the same reasons. And as I was looking for this, I had a hard time finding information.
Yeah, I remember
and,
you saying that.
Yeah, and so that just, again, goes to show, like, the media just didn't do anything about it.
Yeah.
And I was explaining this case to some people, and they all had the same feeling, like, because he was transgender, you know? But law enforcement still won't waver on their suicide ruling, and Alex's family just can't believe that. For all mentioned above, and the fact that Alex had been acting completely fine and normal in the days leading up to his disappearance, his family knows that he had been struggling, but he would have reached out and sought help had he needed it.
Yeah, because he did.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I know sometimes you can't tell when someone is struggling, and they may continue to seem and act normal, and it's a common thing that people do, but Alex's family just has this feeling that he would have reached out to them and told them that he'd been struggling.
Well, he seems like someone who has been very open with his
struggles. Exactly. That's the thing.
Why would he start hiding it now?
Mm-hmm. And he knew when he was struggling, he would go... He checked himself into rehab. Yeah. Like, he does these things because he knows when he's struggling.
Right.
So he doesn't seem like the kind of person who's just going to do something without getting, you know?
Right.
So Alex's family has continued to ask law enforcement to answer the many questions and concerns they have about Alex's death, but they have not received anything. Even to this date, like, emails have been passed back and forth, calls have been made, they are not getting anything. A group called Muddy Waters, a search and rescue group, did a reenactment of what the police claimed happened to Alex. One member of the group sat in the same way and in the same position that Alex had claimed to have been in. Mm-hmm. The group did the reenactment, and they found that nothing that the cops theorized would have been possible. They did the reenactment, and there is just no way that what the police said could have happened.
Yeah.
The group also believes that based on the size of the entry and exit wounds, that the gun used was not the 9mm that had been found under Alex.
Oh, interesting.
They theorized the wound would have come from a 45mm, but surprise, surprise, that was never looked into.
Question. I know that you said that they couldn't find the shell casing, but did they find the bullet?
That's a good question. I don't know. I didn't read a single thing about
that. Because if it
had an entry and exit wound.
Right, then that means...
That's a really good... I didn't think of that, and I didn't find that listed anywhere.
So, because if they didn't find the shell casing, they obviously didn't find the bullet.
Yeah. I found a shell casing at my old neighborhood.
I remember that.
So this is how the police described what happened to Alex to end up in this position. So this is their thing.
Okay.
Quote, based on everything at the scene, it appears that Alex sat down with his legs crossed and shot himself in the right temple.
Like crisscross applesauce?
I think so. Once the shot had occurred, the gun fell to the ground and against the body with his arm laying on top. The upper torso fell directly back, causing him to appear to have been laying on the ground. Which still wouldn't make sense if he was found on his back with his legs crossed at the ankle.
Right, that's not...
It just doesn't make sense.
His legs would be...
Yeah.
Folded
yeah.
Folded in.
Yep. So before his funeral, Pride Lafayette, a group in the greater Lafayette area that advocates for LGBTQ individuals, started a fundraiser on Facebook to help raise money for Alex's funeral expenses.
Oh, that's sweet.
By Wednesday evening, the day of the funeral, the family had raised over $3,200 from nearly 100 people.
Wow.
Ashley Smith, the fundraiser's creator, is quoted saying, and this is really sad, quote, "We did not know Alex, but we do know that no mother should ever have to bury a child."
Ugh.
I'm like getting teary-eyed. So he was someone's child, someone's sibling, someone's grandchild. I don't know why this is making me so
sad.
Emotional. I think it's because I talked to his mom.
Absolutely.
So since this incident, Alex's mother had made a form that had been accepted by Indiana. It asked the Indiana state troopers to take on any cases that the local or county police and sheriffs had denied to take on.
Okay.
Which is actually really cool. So it's kind of saying, like, the police won't do this, so can you do this?
Yeah.
She is also currently trying to get the case reopened in order to have it looked at again and has a petition open for this to happen. There's also a GoFundMe that the family has started with a goal of $2,000 to be used to help hire a private investigator. So I'll post all of those links in the show notes.
Sure.
Part of the description on the GoFundMe page says, quote, "We are asking for donations to help get the case reopened, the case of death reclassified. We need justice for Alex." So I'll also post that. And I did sign the petition. So if other people can sign it, that would be wonderful. If you have the funds or the time, please go sign the petition, help with the GoFundMe.
Absolutely.
Literally any little bit helps. There's also a Facebook page entitled Justice for Alex Brake Van Dalsen that has additional information about the case. And if you have any information at all regarding Alex Van Dalsen's case, please call the Tippecanoe County Sheriff's Department at 765-423-9388. So that is Alex Van Dalsen's case.
That is so sad.
And I think it's just like, and I think this one got me because like I spoke to like... So when you do true crime and you listen to true crime, mm-hmm. you know that everyone who was a victim is like, they had a family, they had
sure.
a life, they were people, like, you know, they were a person,
yeah.
like a full person. But when you speak to the family members
yeah.
and you get that kind of different...
It's not just a story anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So hopefully we can find something.
Hopefully.
There's, you know, because it happened so recently too
yeah.
that there's still time. Like, there's still ways that we can figure out what happened because... I don't believe it was a suicide.
It doesn't sound like it was.
I believe there are way too many, like, weird things about the case that there's just no way it could be a suicide.
Well, and it's like, you know, if the dog lost the scent and then, which means he might have gotten picked up.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, even hypothetically speaking, if he did commit suicide,
mm-hmm.
he wouldn't have walked there
no.
because he wouldn't physically be capable.
There's no way.
And so he would have taken his own car.
Mm-hmm.
That was nowhere there.
But like, say hypothetically, too, because one of the police reports did say that if he had, like, a friend with him who drove him to this location and picked up the gun casing, there's no way they could charge that friend. But it's also, if there is a second person, hopefully that person comes forward and says, hey, I can give you additional information about what happened.
Why would anyone sit there and watch someone commit suicide?
I don't know. I have no answers.
That's wild.
Yeah. But, yeah.
Hmm.
So that's Indiana.
Well, hopefully Alex can get some justice.
I hope so, too. So thank you for listening, everyone. Thank you for being on here with me, Mackenzie.
Of course, I had a lot of fun.
I had a lot of fun having you on here too.
Yeah.
It's so fun having like all my friends on it because they're like, oh my God, listen to this research I did. Oh my God, I'm so excited.
I am.
It makes me so happy.
I have my research ready to go for the next one.
I know. So if you guys could like and rate us on iTunes, on Spotify, that would be wonderful. We also have social media at A Scary State Podcast. If you have any scary stories, run-ins with a serial killer, haunted, anything, please send them to ascarystatepodcast@gmail.com. I just need a couple more stories and I can do a whole other listeners episode, which would be really
awesome.
Exciting. And I think that's about all. So stay scary.
Stay safe.